But what we're actually selling is success and selectivity, at least on the network aspect. We've done all the pre-screening, and the people who end up in the room, you know, 98% of the time are of the seniority that they want to engage with. It is true, when you get a bunch of decision makers in a room, you are influencing influential people. Everyone in the room is over huge organizations where their budget allocation or the decisions they make have implications. Yeah, for sure.
With great power comes great responsibility, Spider-Man. Trevor, welcome to the pod.
Welcome to Dubai. Thanks so much for having me on. It's great to meet you in person.
Your name cropped up a lot.
Really?
Yes.
Serious about that.
Your name cropped up a lot.
And that makes someone nervous when someone says that.
It's a good thing I'm big on personal branding, so take it as a compliment.
Okay.
Meant in that way. Because when I was coming out, I was like, in Ireland, I kind of know, not know everybody, but I'm one person away, right?
Yeah.
I'm one person away from whoever. Whereas when I was coming out here, I was like, I knew one person, Owen Bulger. I didn't really know anyone else. I was like, right, I've kind of like start building a network quite rapidly here. And it's hard. But I asked a few people, I was like, oh, you've been there, you know this, and your name cropped up. And people said the same thing. He's building something cool. I was like, what's he building? They're like, not entirely sure.
I could see how people...
And then I went on your website and I was like, I'm intrigued. I'm in.
What are you building? What am I building? Well, I guess it's not just me. It's a whole team of people. And it's happened over the course of the last 12 years. And we are now an advisory firm that works with CEOs and ministers and boards, essentially. And we do that in, we've a kind of an ABCD offering. So the A is the advisory. We have about 40 senior advisors. These are all very highly accomplished individuals, former ministers, global CEOs, economists, all interesting variety of individuals. The B is Boardroom, which is our intelligence network. So this is what the business was first built on. And that is a membership for CEOs and government officials where we give them information about geopolitics, geoeconomics, how government policy is in engaging with the private sector, what's happening in the region and what it means for a senior decision maker. The C is consulting. So we consult really upstream from an RFP. So before there's any kind of request for a proposal, we'll go in and help the board or the government establish what is the interest and idea, and then bring in, you know, the consultants. We don't really, although it is a consulting practice, we don't really consider ourselves in that space. We will sit down with the board and say, okay, you're trying to do something that's never been done before. Here's interest and ideas of how this could potentially take shape. And then these, we will identify then through our network, now bring in these consultants, but now bring in McKinsey or BCG or whoever it might be.
Okay.
Because we don't want to, and we don't want to compete with them, and we don't really want to go down the route, the model that they have. And then the D is deal making. So we have these networks in different cities. And yes, these clients pay a membership to be part of the network itself, these CEOs. But then over time, hopefully, we're not perfect, but hopefully they see we try to do things to a high standard. Trust is built. And then typically what happens is they say, you know, I'm trying to do X, Y, and Z. I'm trying to buy this asset, sell this asset. I want to acquire a company, partner with the government, whatever it might be. Can you help us do that? And we'll do that then from an advisory capacity on a retainer, and then even sit in between these deals on a success fee.
Okay.
So that's it.
It's pretty interesting.
Well,
Let's go back to the start.
Well, as I say, it was 12 years ago, and I was working at The Economist in the EIU, the Economist Intelligence Unit, and basically doing country analysis, right? So again, geopolitics, economy, policy, everything that will impact a country, from an environmental perspective, obviously of late, you know, from a technological point of view, what is AI? How is that going to impact different markets? And I was at The Economist, great brand, Great people, very sharp, very bright people. Mm-hmm. But when I did get there, that was the place I kind of wanted to get into.
Where were we based?
Well, there for in the UAE in Dubai, but I'd been all over the Middle East. So I was in Istanbul, in Doha, in Riyadh, Abu Dhabi, and then Dubai.
Had you been doing that in all those different areas, or was
it, okay, exactly
for The Economist?
Different, but The Economist was the one that I wanted to end up in or get into. And I got in there, as I say, it was a circuitous route, and I got there, and it's kind of like, this is the place I wanted to get into. And then I quickly realized it was kind of, you know, like all organizations, the same as any other organization. And but a great brand and great people and a great company. And so it was in the back of my mind, this is the place I wanted to get into. If this isn't for me, then I should really try and build something for myself. And that was it then. And I'd done something, you know, remarkably stupid. I'd saved all my life savings, which wasn't a huge amount of money, but it was all the money I had. And it was a big chunk of change, just to be fair. And they don't call it The Economist for nothing. They didn't pay. they were clever with how they retained their talent. And so I had my savings, and I knew the risk was me staying somewhere that, you know, I didn't really want to be frank. So then it didn't even really feel like a risk. So I had my life savings. I handed in my notice. I tried selling reports. That's basically I was doing write reports. And then I had basically went down the route of, okay, let's try this network membership model.
Where were you living at the time?
In Dubai.
You were already here.
Yeah. Okay. And I went and I hired the ballroom of Burj Al Arab. And I was very naive, as you can imagine. And I, yeah, hired the ballroom. We invited everybody that I knew. I had a friend of mine, actually, a good friend of mine, who was working. This is funny. I won't mention the name he was working for, actually, but he was working for a big engineering company. And obviously I had no resources. And I said to him, look, this is what I'm doing. And he came, he put on a suit. I gave him a clipboard, the ballroom of Burj Al Arab. And as everybody who had invited, as they were walking into the room, he was standing there like ticking the clipboard as if there was something even on the clipboard. There wasn't. You know, as if we had this kind of infrastructure. Yeah. And I was like, oh, yes,
yeah, look, optics matter.
And that was that. So I stood up.
What was this for? What were we hiring it for? Like a launch? Or this is your kind
of... This is, yeah. So as part of the network, really what they're getting access to is briefings. So
right.
I'll give a briefing about what's happening in the region, what's happening in the country, maybe what's happening from a global point of view, what it means for us, right? From a geopolitical and geoeconomic point of view. And then... what does that mean in terms of strategy? And it's a private, off the record, no one's allowed to post to social media, no one's allowed to record anything. And yeah, I'll share my views, I'll give a talk and then facilitate interaction. That's how we used to do it back in Burj Al Arab for many years. And off the back of that first one then, I'd hosted the event, I had people come, I saw there was, okay, there's some traction here. And I was basically trying to do everything myself, you know?
How did you get people to come to the first one?
Complimentary invite, come along. Who wants to have breakfast at Burj Al Arab, basically?
Fair.
Which, you know, but I guess there was a bit more to it than that, to be fair to us. And off the back of that, then I'd follow up with people. And... yeah, I could see people were like, no, I enjoyed that. And we bundled benefits together and that became the membership. And yeah, for the last 12 years, every quarter, we host a large briefing. Now, you know, we'll host one this week. And there's usually like our Q4, we'd 400. Our Q1 next week will be 200 plus CEOs. Private room, I give a talk. We facilitate discussion and then they get access to reports and data and depending on what tier they're on, they get access to me or et cetera, et cetera. So it built from there. And for many years, I was just focused on the network and building that network and trying to make it as sophisticated as possible, in the sense that when you build a network, particularly an elite network where you have decision makers who sit over huge budgets, then there is a circle of individuals who are trying to get into that. And you can make a lot more money, to be frank, if you let those people in. So in the early days, you know, I had private banks, wealth managers, real estate people saying, oh, I'll give you a big chunk of change and we'll sponsor your event. But really what they wanted was your CRM. So I always turned that down and always rejected that. And I think over the years, the members could see we have selection criteria of who can become a member. We are very fastidious in terms of that selection criteria. So when they take time out of their busy schedules, they're gone and they know it's a couple of hours where they're actually going to meet their peers. And hopefully we're, you know, delivering some thought-provoking content that is useful that they can bring back to the office then.
Mm. The curation piece is so important, though. Yeah. So, especially when you talk about an elite network, like they do not want to be getting pinged emails from every single person.
Absolutely. And then if they're gone, the other challenge we have is everybody in the room could be the person on the stage giving the talk, right?
Okay.
They're all top regional CEOs. So they're probably not used to being in the audience. They're used to being on the stage.
Telling it how it is.
Exactly. So then you really need to ensure what you're delivering is something where it's capturing their attention and they find it of value. And then over the years, it developed in different ways. We have an app. We survey all the members. We disaggregate the data and we give it back to them. So it becomes quite a valuable tool for them in terms of benchmark and expectations relative to their peers.
It's a chicken and egg thing, though, Trevor. This is what I was curious to chat to you about. Like, you start off with kind of no members.
Mm.
You know, no one wants to walk into an empty bar, right?
Exactly.
So how did you get the first 10 sales? I always ask people, how did you get the first 10 customers? For you, it's really interesting. How did you get your first 10 members? Because it's the thing of like, well, who else is in? A guy was emailing me last week. He's like, oh, I think you should come on this podcast thing. We're going to get like 6 people together for the next 6 months. I was like, ah, she sounds really good. I was like, who else is in? He's like, oh, you'd be the first. I was like, let me know when you get a few people. And I was like, if you get a few people that I could really get on with, because I think it'd be really valuable. Peer networks are invaluable. Yeah. I'm a huge advocate for them, but I didn't want to be the first.
Exactly.
Because I'm like, if I'm the first, I don't want to be the guy that's first. I want to be punching up. I want to be meeting like podcasters who are doing 10 million a month.
Yeah.
So how did you get over that hurdle?
Look, before I answer that, I think it's interesting. And our first two members, I remember, and they're both still our members 12 years later. So that I'm always quite proud of. And, you know, those first members, I'm trying to think back when it was me doing those sales, basically. I think part of it is that when you go in, you see a full room. And I guess at the beginning, I wasn't exactly saying, you know, this is our first event and this is... I just speak as if this is something we're doing, which we are. Yeah. So I think obviously that kind of gave the sense that, okay, there's all these CEOs in the room. But back then it wasn't as senior. So it was part of the journey was really first you need volume, right? And then to ensure that you're building a network that is of decision makers, then you have to go through this painful process of introducing seniority rules, selection criteria, etc. And then you piss off a lot of people who at the beginning were the ones that also were, you know, coming to the sessions.
In the ballroom. Yeah.
So that was a bit of a journey, you know, in terms of, okay, we've now, we're getting this critical mass. Now we need to bring it up here. And to do that, then you have to let people go. Or as it actually played out was we lost some clients as a result of it, where we're saying, look, your regional director or your CMO can't come to the events anymore. And they'd say, well, we signed up for the membership. And sure. And when that membership agreement expires, we'd love to see you renew, obviously. But if you don't, you know, we understand, but it will be on the basis that it's the regional number one.
Had you a company membership at the start?
It is a corporate membership still now, okay. But it's for the regional number one, which is typically, you know, regional CEO, president, VP, whatever the title is, but the decision maker overseeing the region in Dubai. And in the early days, and I'm even trying to, you know, pull up my memories here. I remember, you know, with some of the memberships, if they had a secondary member, it might have been their CMO or their, you know, director of government affairs. And then we introduced this rule saying, we're sorry.
Number ones only.
Number ones. And then depending on what tier you're on, they'd nominate a number two if they're traveling.
Okay.
Yeah. So that, it takes time, man.
Yeah. Like, it sounded like a tough model to build. That's why I was so curious to chat to you. I was like, this is really interesting. But like,
well, the interesting thing is, if I don't think I'd do it now with all the, you know, you get older and you have the benefit of experience, or, you know, you hope you do. And if somebody, I invest in a lot of companies, and if somebody came to me asking me to invest in this, a model that is primarily physical and focused on a very niche audience that is very difficult to capture, especially in this part of the world where events are free, right? Now, there's a lot more to us than just the briefings, right? There's the reports and data and all this, but essentially, there's no shortage of events in Dubai, and they're all free, and they're not very good. They're sponsor led. You're going, you're listening to, you know, some representative from a company who sponsored, telling
all over the world, whatever. Like those free events, like you just,
yes,
it's painful.
And so doubling down on standards and high standards, and we're not perfect, but trying to always be psychotic in terms of your standards. Eventually people see that, and eventually they start to speak to one another and they say, oh, this one's different. And actually, you know, it does do what it says on the tin. It is, when you go to the room, it's like, ah, okay, these are all the people running. These are the most powerful people here.
Yeah. And I imagine it only takes a couple of events for people to go, yeah, this is different, because people have been to enough bad events.
Yeah.
And like, time is the most important thing people have, especially that level. Jeez. Like,
yes.
The only thing they have is like time.
Yeah.
So to get people to come in and spend a couple of hours with you in a morning, like it's complex, not an easy business to build.
And part of it is, I do often say, it's like, you know, it's a chemistry you're creating.
Mm.
There's a lot of hidden aspects to it. There's hidden desires, the psychology of selectivity involved in it. There's the reasons why they become members, but they'll never say that they're becoming members. You know, so that's what I'm, you know, trying to get across to the team at times. It's like, what are we selling here? Right. And they'll list all these benefits of making, you know, more informed decisions, and all of that is true. And, you know, the network aspect and connecting into partnerships and growth. And yes, that's all true. But what we're actually selling is success and selectivity, at least on the network aspect. We've done all the pre-screening, and the people who end up in the room, you know, 98% of the time are of the seniority that they want to engage with. And that, in a way, is part of why, and we charge a premium. And that's part of it. It's, you're paying for the screening. You know, in a way, it's Harvard, right? You often hear Harvard, you can go and get the education in a library, but part of what you're paying for is the selectivity of the other people who have been allowed in.
I would imagine the network as well. I would imagine.
Definitely.
They're cultivating a network of which are peers. It's really quite hard to meet people at that level who don't want something from you.
Yeah.
I mean, most people are probably trying to sell to these people. They're probably trying to like get access to them for an hour, tell them about this great new thing, whereas they're on a level playing field, which you've created.
Yeah.
Incredible power to be the curator.
Yeah, somebody actually, an Italian friend of mine, who's the chairman of a big actual events company here, and we lunched a couple of weeks ago, and this is what he was saying, and he made a real kind of, was very visceral point, and he said, like, sure, we were having lunch. He's like, we can talk about doing all these different things together. This is what I wanted to actually say to you is, do you understand the responsibility you have with all of this? And I kind of, you know, I know it sounds naive, but I kind of thought, yeah, I suppose I did. But he made such a point of it that perhaps I'd underestimated it as well, you know?
How do you mean? As in, like, you shape decisions, you shape people's viewpoints? What do you mean?
Yeah, well, for him particularly, from his viewpoint, it was the convening of decision makers around topics that have implications for broader society, right? But also then in terms of the information and how we influence them with what we feel is going on. If you have 250 regional CEOs in a room and we're saying, you know, without mentioning anything, X, Y, and Z is happening, and here's the reasons why we think this is a bad idea and you shouldn't do it. And then we do a survey, and I'm thinking of a specific example here. Then we'll do a survey of everybody, and everyone's saying they're not doing it. And then you start to realize, okay, we need to be careful because we need to do the survey first.
Okay.
Because we're actually influencing in...
So you could tank a region, an industry, a company...
Well, I wouldn't say that, but I'd say it has an implication in terms of decision making, and everyone in the room is over huge organizations where their budget allocation or the decisions they make have implications. Mm. Yeah, for sure.
With great power comes great responsibility, Spider-Man. Yeah. That kind of stuff he's giving you. He'd need a hand on your shoulder.
That's what he was
giving you the suit.
I guess it didn't really dawn on me that much. And obviously there's an array of different aspects where they're getting information from different sources. And but it is true, when you get a bunch of decision makers in a room, you are influencing influential people.
Sure, but surely this is what we need more of in the world. If anything, we need more of that kind of thing.
It depends who's influencing them, right? You know, we all like to think of ourselves as being the righteous one. Who is
impartial, unbiased, neutral.
That's not how the world operates, right?
Sure, it's not.
You know?
But we see it every day. Like, I think no one's naive. No one doesn't mean this isn't happening in rooms all over the world right now.
Yeah.
Where deals have been done, secret deals or public deals, whatever. This is just how the world works.
Yeah.
You want it to work that way or you don't, but that's how the world works.
Now, to be clear, nobody is doing secret deals at our...
Of course not. Of course not. It takes courage and belief in yourself and your business idea to take the step to set up your own business. In the early stages, entrepreneurship can be a lonely road, even through milestone moments. Deciding to commit the idea you've been mulling over, learning, growing, and developing your skills, building a team to help you along the way, and preparing to launch into new markets. Enterprise Ireland is there for all of those startup moments. From providing advice and guidance to new founders through our startup network, to pre-seed funding and early investment, we're here to help you bring your ambition to fruition. To find out how Enterprise Ireland can help you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Before we dive into today's episode, I want to share a game changer for your business, Azure Communications. When it comes to print and marketing solutions, these folks, led by CEO Jenny Johnston, are the real deal. Whether you need an eye-catching brochure, sleek business cards, or a full-blown digital campaign, Azure Communications has you covered. They're not just about high-quality prints or digital campaigns. They're also about delivering great results. And here's the best part. Just for listeners of The Entrepreneur Experiment, you can get 20% off your first order. Just give them a call or go online and use the code VOX20. With personalized service and fast turnaround times, Azure Communications will help you make the impact your business deserves. Trust me, when it comes to making your brand stand out, Azure Communications is the provider of choice. Check them out at azurecom.ie. Use code FOX20 and elevate your marketing game today. Nostra, an Irish IT company, offers world-class managed IT services, cloud solutions, IT support, and more, all tailored to meet your business needs. So whether you're streamlining operations or boosting productivity, their expert team is ready to help you. Visit nostra.ie or email info@nostra.ie to see how they can help solve your IT challenges today. But you know what I mean? People have that. I think after COVID, a lot of trust has been lost in the world, right? A lot of trust in political leaders, especially the media, stuff like that. So anything that makes people more informed, especially leaders, surely can only be a good service to the world.
Well, I think, you know, it seems the world is so polarized that everybody is in their camps.
Yeah.
So everybody is being fed or sitting in their own echo chamber.
Mm.
So we all feel like our echo chamber is the right one. And I think being very mindful of the fact and having humility that you recognize that, and this is one of the great things, I think, one of the things I'm really grateful for in terms of being able to build a business is you meet so many really high achieving, high functioning individuals who are super bright, very well educated, have achieved an awful lot, well-adjusted people, you know, good people, good family people, all the stuff that goes with that. And they can just have this diametrically opposed view to you on something that you couldn't understand that. How could they come to that conclusion? And I think when I was younger, you know, my natural position over this, you know, kind of 20 years ago would have been to revert into your camp, right? Of, no, well, that person is wrong. And now I'm just, I realize how I could just be wrong.
Mm.
And I'm so curious about how somebody who is, as I say, as high functioning an individual could see the world totally different than I could. And it just makes me curious about that person. It makes me want to spend more time with them, actually.
But that's a great way to be. And more people should be like that, because if we just even understand how they got to that decision, you don't have to agree with it.
Mm.
You don't have to like it even.
Yeah.
But if you can just understand how they got there.
Because I think, you know, where the world is heading over, even by the end of this decade, but certainly over the next kind of 25 years, it's going to be for a significant cohort of the global population, it will be the most exciting, exhilarating time to be alive, and it will be unbridled in terms of opportunity. But I would say the vast, hopefully not the vast majority, but certainly billions and billions of people are just heading for this untold suffering where we're heading in the world, in terms of even just what's happening now. Here we are at the start of 2025, right? If you look how the world's going to change and by the end of this year, right? And I think we really underestimate this from a geopolitical and geoeconomic perspective, where even just say, if you start out from a geopolitical point of view, you have what is like a volcano erupting, right? I was saying this in one of my talks. It's a great story, right? So on the 5th of April, 1815, right? It was this island in Indonesia, Sumbawa Island, right? Beautiful, green, idyllic, you know, lush paradise-like island. And a volcano erupted, Mount Tambora, yeah, on the island. And obviously the people were sadly wiped out on that island, right? Would have been it's modern day Indonesia. But that wasn't just any volcano. It was the largest eruption in recorded human history, right? And it belched these noxious gases and volcanic ash high up into the atmosphere. Stratospheric implications for all the world, right? You had the monsoon season in Asia. The rain stopped. There was drought, hunger, famine. In 1816, the year later in Europe, right? Historians call it the year of no summer. There was still this dark pall cloud in the sky. And there was almost constant volcanic rain or ash in the rain, which obviously impacted farmers, which then led to hunger. Hunger leads to desperation. Desperation, as it always does, and we always, as our species, I think about this a lot, I'm blown away that we're always surprised when desperation turns to violence. I never get that. So there's food riots in Britain, in France, European capitals. There's looting. Think of Switzerland, right? You think of Switzerland today, you think of this, again, landlocked, peaceful, idyllic type of country. Swiss government declare a national emergency, right? So you think of that, an event that took place on the other side of the world, got into the weather system and had all of these implications all around the world. That's exactly what is happening today. But what we have is this geopolitical, geoeconomic, sociocultural, technological environment volcano which is Trump 2.0 and AI. And if you look at Trump in the last few weeks since he's been in power, for good or ill, I'm not pro-Trump, I'm not anti-Trump, I'm kind of a dispassionate observer.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of curious of, wow, this is going to change the world. From a geopolitical point of view, you see that we're entering into this really a new era of geopolitics. He is a very unique and different individual. And yes, you have this era of multipolarity, right? Really, you had Obama begins to kind of disengage a little bit, right? Particularly from the Middle East. And you have Trump and you have America First and more of an isolationist type of policy. Then you have Biden, Biden was essentially the same president as Trump. No one wants to say this, but from a foreign policy point of view. And you have Trump again. And you have, you know, this multipolarity where you have China, you have the US, you have Russia to a lesser extent. And that was something we've all kind of anticipated and kind of saw, particularly since Putin went into Ukraine. But now what you have is this kind of predatory multipolarity where you have Trump chiding Mexico and the Gulf of Mexico or the Gulf of America. You have chiding Canada, Panama, Greenland. And I think a lot of people really underestimate what is actually going on here. You know, geography matters, right? Geography, right? Land, earth. We're the only species that we write on our land. Why do we do that? There's a great political geographer, Yves Lacoste from the 70s. And he says in French, but I won't, so I'm not sophisticated enough. He says, geography first and foremost is about warfare. It's about war making. It's the othering of the other individual. And I really feel now in this era, you have Trump and the people around him recognize that Putin was able to go into Ukraine. The ramifications of that were manageable for Russia. And now we have this kind of bifurcation of the global economy between US and between China. And you have a president that is very much willing to test the powers of what we would have considered kind of sovereign nations. You have, from a geoeconomic point of view, you have him pulling out of the global tax treaty. And you have, obviously, from an AI point of view, you have Stargate, you have the Chinese, and this whole kind of century is going to be defined by knowledge supremacy.
Okay.
And this is before you get to the environment. So you have quite a fractious global system. And then at the same time, as a species, and for the vast majority of the population, what we need is multilateralism to bring these different parties together in order to solve climate change. And in actual fact, the opposite has taken place, where Trump has pulled out of Paris Accords, etc. And you would have to say 1.5 is dead, right? I think if you look at the carbon budget between now and the end of the decade, we have to cut projected carbon emissions by 2030 or for 2030 by, I think it's 48-49%. And if you look at the progress we've made, we've added to it.
It seems, but it always seemed completely unrealistic.
Well, yeah.
So you had this unicorn event of all these things are going to happen. And you're kind of looking at going, I'm no economist or scientist, but surely that seems wildly ambitious.
Well, 1.5, it seems, sadly, it is. 2 degrees seems very, very optimistic. And then this is all, so then what you have, so that you've got these huge challenges that the world is facing. And then at the same time, so we know that there's a lot of flux and instability coming from that direction. And I don't mean, you know, a long time away. I mean, we're seeing this now in terms of extreme weather events already.
Yeah.
It's here. We saw it in Dubai last year.
Yeah, the floods, that was incredible.
Like, exactly.
Seeing it all, like in Ireland now, on a minor scale, we're having these category red storms with increasing frequency. They're like, this is a critical Oh, this is a danger to life event.
More than 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I was in Ireland in January, and there was the snow. We had to go down to Cork, and similar, everybody saying you're not to travel. But I guess the point I'm making is you have this huge chapter of instability ahead of us. And then at the same time, what we're all missing is you have the vast majority of population growth, right? If you look at global demography and where it's going to happen, you have another 1 billion people added by the end of this decade, 2 billion by 2050. You put that into context, in 1800, we reached our first 1 billion people, right? So now we're on 8. We had another by the end of this decade, another 2 by 2050. And you've got about 90% of all of that growth happening in Africa and Asia, actually in 8 countries.
8?
Yeah.
Wow.
8 countries. You're looking at the likes of Egypt, Nigeria, Indonesia, India, Pakistan, Congo. The vast majority of population is coming from countries that are also going to face the worst effects of climate change. And you will have hundreds and millions of people. And I would do the same. They are going to, if you break it down a bit, I think the UN puts it at 240 million people. But so let's say it's even just, let's be very conservative about it, right? Let's say it's 100 million people. And let's say you have slow onset change, right? Rising temperatures. These are the people that will move over borders, right? Because agriculture will be impacted. Yeah. Then you'll have fast onset events. These will be people that will move into cities, maybe not over borders, but into cities and pile huge infrastructure strain onto these cities. But if you take the first category, let's say it's 100 million people, very conservative. And most of these people are going to move north. They move into Europe. Europe votes right when this happens.
Yep, see, happened already.
Yeah, things get very, very messy. Even though, the irony being, again, from a demographic point of view, these are the countries that actually will need the immigration to fuel their economies into the future, you know? And when you take that into account, and you take into account the sheer magnitude of people moving over borders and how we're managing it now, like think of it, when was it 2014, 2015, the Syrian refugee crisis, right? 1 million left Syria and headed into Europe. Like that ended up, even though it wasn't going to impact Britain from a Schengen point of view, that ended up like a core part of the Brexit debate. Remember, they had billboards up of the immigrants and whatnot. That was 1 million people. Think of a quantum of 100, and that's conservative. So you do, it'd be hard not to worry about how we solve that. And there'll be certain parts of the world that will just thrive. There will be people and individuals. That will be turned into huge opportunities for them.
What kind of opportunities are there? Because if there's business people listening, they're like, okay, this all sounds pretty bleak. But what's the opportunity here? Where does Trevor think we actually can win here?
Well, it's not even, you know, that would depend on industry and sector, but everything, and I often think about this, it's not opportunity or challenge. It's just like thinking makes it so, right? I think it was Shakespeare, right? It's not good or bad. Thinking makes it so.
Good quote to live by. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's the same with, you know, if you're looking at things through the lens of how do I adapt, right? Speaking of demographics, right? The Japanification of Europe. Just look at Japan, right? Japan now sells more adult nappies or diapers for our American friends than nappies for babies.
I read that recently.
And the main brand there has reconfigured their manufacturing plant to serve adult nappies. So I was talking to my wife about this. She was just back from Japan last week or the week before. And I was saying, if I was young again, like say I was leaving school or university or whatever, and how would I... obviously you want to look at your life and ask yourself, how do I want my life to look, and then build a business opportunity around that. So it's not the other way around. And one thing for me would be, I love traveling, going out. I'm very curious going out and seeing the world. And how could I do that? And how could I turn it into a way that would then fund this passion as well? And I'm young and I'm going and enjoying all the pleasures of the world, right? And I was thinking about this and I was saying, you know, if I was a kid again, I have my nephew there in the green room who's over in Dubai for his work experience. You know, he's in fourth year. And what I would do is I would stay in Ireland and I would save as much money as I can. Let's say save 50 grand, right? So you'd have to work a little while and you'd have to be disciplined and put it into your piggy bank. And then what I would do is I would head to Japan, or I would look at the demography of different countries around the world, but Japan would be a perfect example of it. It won't be too long till there's countries in Europe that will fall into this as well, where they, because of the demography, they have an oversupply of housing. And there's islands off Japan. I don't know if you travel around Japan much.
No, no.
Incredible, incredible country. There's islands off Japan. And there's an oversupply of traditional houses where the young population sadly aren't as engaged with their culture as much as it was proven to be the case in the past. And you can pick up houses there for $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000. It's kind of like, remember, there's a scheme in Italy.
Italy, the €1 thing, you can rent it for 100 or something.
Exactly. Like, so same thing, these incredible islands, rural areas, pick up a house for 10,000, right? Put another 30, 40 into it. And then you make sure within the radius of that house, the radius of that island, you're an hour away from a major city. You have good infrastructure in terms of transportation. And then you Airbnb that place out, and you'll Airbnb it out for $150, because people may not want to live on that beautiful, idyllic rural, but they want to go and take their photo.
Which is Japan. Yeah, I get you.
And then you bank that money, and then you buy your next one.
Yeah.
And that's why understanding what's happening in the world is so, so important, because it's not an opportunity or a challenge. It's just thinking makes it so, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think it's so interesting to chat to you about these kind of broader things, because you have a unique perspective, especially where you're based here.
Mm.
Because you can kind of, I think it's great to see things from a removed kind of like perspective. So like when you look back at Ireland now, how long are you here?
I mean, the broader Middle East, depending on your definition, the Middle East, nearly 18, 19 years. My wife is great. She tells me exactly.
Yeah, I'm not big on detail either.
Yeah.
So you can see things from remove. I know you travel home quite a bit as well.
Yeah. So you have a place in Ireland. So we're back and forth. And
okay,
we've actually spent a lot of time back in Ireland the last kind of year and a half, because my parents are getting older and my father hasn't been well. So
okay,
I was spending quite a bit of time there, which I really enjoyed.
But you're perfectly placed to answer this question for me. So because a lot of negativity in Ireland at the minute, and people are kind of like, the sky is falling. What's your perspective of Ireland now as someone who's kind of from there originally, but has spent a great deal of time abroad, and your job it is essentially to analyze things? What's your analysis on Ireland?
Great question. And it's funny because I've always had a bit of a neurotic relationship with Ireland. I love Ireland. I love the people. I think, and that's what I've enjoyed. I enjoyed being back there the most, is the people. And but then also with the benefit of leaving, you have a kind of distance that you can look at it in a different way. And I think Ireland's a huge success story. I know that may not feel that to a lot of people when there's a housing crisis, homelessness. You know, you don't need to take much of a walk through Dublin to recognize the problems in Ireland.
The city's in a funny place.
Yeah. Yet at the same time, we're a unique country in the sense that we have too much money as a government, right? We're creating sovereign wealth funds. We're creating investments for the future for the inevitable change that we spoke about earlier on. And we have a unique model in terms of not just a low corporate tax rate. I think a lot of people make that point. And they probably oversell it a bit.
It's a little bit lazy at this stage. Okay.
Yeah. It's a gateway market into Europe. You have double taxation treaties. You have a highly talented workforce, highly well-educated. So there's a lot of great things about Ireland. The challenge, and this is going to be the challenge for everywhere in the world, particularly now with AI, is just the level of inequality is going to go like this. And from an AI point of view, you don't need a great deal of quantitative insight to figure out that the people who are going to already control assets are going to use AI to their advantage. And that in the simplest case would be a business, a medium-sized company. Now they're going to need far fewer staff to do that. And the benefits, the way free market capitalism works, the benefits flow to the top. I feel that's going to broaden actually inequality. And that's been the main, at least looking at it from a distance, that's been the thing with Ireland. I can see there's this, where when you look at any of the metrics of Ireland, we're a very wealthy country. It doesn't feel like a wealthy country. It doesn't, when you're walking around Dublin, you don't think, oh, wow. Now, I know a lot of that sits on balance sheets as IP, but even putting that to one side, I feel that inequality issue is going to be the bigger piece. But what also in this debate, what people, at least in my view, always forget, or it kind of impoverishes the whole debate when you don't look at the legacy. Everything is built onto something. The big things rest on the little things. And the legacy for Ireland was that the Irish government, for its good and ill, over the years, they had a certain hand to play, a certain economic hand to play, right? If you think of Ireland in the 80s, right? I was born in 1980, and it was a tough, Ireland was one of the poorest countries in Europe. And the government had a opportunity, which was, now a lot of people, as I mentioned, have this accusation as Ireland's a McDonald's drive-through for tax evasion, you know? And again, that's a very lazy analysis of it. Yes, we have a very competitive tax rate, which will be interesting how President Trump and his policies may impact that. But from Ireland's point of view, these were the cards that we had to play. It was a case of we tax at 40% and we get 40% of nothing, or we can tax at 12.5% and get 12.5%, which now has turned into far more than they would have ever got in the first place. And now from a tax policy perspective, Ireland is a very interesting model. So it's remembering where we came from, you know, the 80s in Ireland.
Bullish or bearish?
For Ireland in the future, again, everything depends on what happens globally. We're a very open, affluent, supposedly, open, affluent, trading economy that's based on the global economy. And now you have Trump pulling out of the global tax treaty, and that will put pressure on the OECD commitments of a 15% baseline tax rate for companies. And I feel that may, like, here is a good example. UAE had decided, okay, we're introducing corporate tax, and we're also going to introduce the OECD standard for companies that are revenuing a certain amount. Okay. Now Trump comes into power very, very recently, and he's pulling out of these global tax agreements. And he's saying to countries, they could put pressure on these companies to get the tax, the top-up tax, the difference, okay, between the tax rates. That's, he's making it very clear, as Trumpian policy often does, in a very kind of, he browbeats people, that they won't stand for that. So now if it puts a lot of pressure on all of these other countries, because now they say, well, if the US isn't doing it, and the US is the apex predator in terms of global geopolitics, does it make sense for us to do it? You know, are we putting ourselves at a competitive disadvantage? So again, that kind of fractures a lot of progress, or at least from a tax point of view, that had moved forward. And that has how that plays out for Ireland is a huge thing. Because while I say that the competitive tax rate isn't the only advantage, it is a very important one. Mm. And you have a lot of innovation-led industries in terms of tech and pharma, as you know, in Ireland. And tax isn't the only decision they make, but if President Trump is putting huge pressure on them to bring manufacturing back to the US, and then if I remember correctly, if you look at corporate tax in Ireland, if you look at it proportionally or as a percentage, it's, and I'm getting this wrong, right, just to be clear for everybody, but it's something like 5 or 6 multinationals account for 80% or something.
4.
Is it? Right.
It's Stephen Kinsella on the clip on Mega Viral. He's like 4.
4. Okay. So,
and I was like, ballpark, you know, sketch this out for me, like I'm doing with you. I was like, sketch this out for me. He was like, could that happen? He goes, anything's possible.
Yeah.
I was like, whoa, that would be literally lights off, last one, turn off the lights and you're aware.
Well, look, it happens all the time in different regions, right? Gravitational pull, markets of influence, or markets that have momentum, and then it shifts. Some here in the Middle East, you don't have to go back too far. It was Bahrain. Bahrain was the financial center. Kuwait was a paragon of development. It shifts around, you know. UAE has definitely, you know, very much kind of copper fastened its reputation as not just a regional hub, but now a global hub. But Riyadh in Saudi now is also competing and wants to be the regional hub. So things change, and they change.
Each continent has changed.
Yeah, and they can change pretty quickly in the space of like 5 to 9 years. It can feel like, there's a network effect that I think a lot of people discount in this, in terms of the human nature, the aspect of human nature when it comes to investment decisions. How does a certain city become an EMEA HQ like Ireland for tech companies? How does UAE and Dubai specifically become a regional and in many ways now an international hub? It's because of the human aspect of, oh, what are you guys doing?
Yeah.
You know, or in your sector. Ah, okay. You know, whoever, without mentioning names, the big brands, such and such as have gone in. Okay.
We mimic and copy. Yeah. We have done since the caveman era.
But you would imagine that at a global boardroom level that it's a lot more sophisticated. And when the global CEOs come in, as part of the membership product at least, I'll often give them talks. I'm, you know, the regional CEO will wheel me out to give a talk to the global CEO. And what I've learned over the last decade is that these decisions, the decision-making process is not as sophisticated as you imagine. A lot of it is, what are they doing? I've heard they're doing this. So it's
human beings aren't fully rational. Surprise, surprise. We're not like computers. We don't like go, oh, that is makes complete logical sense. I look at Trevor and go, Trevor seems like he's got it figured out. Let's do what he's doing.
Yeah.
We all do that. Like, we're delusional. From like the smallest decision in our life to the biggest decisions, we're influenced by our peer group. That's why I was think your model is so interesting. I'm like, it's so interesting because like we are heavily influenced by our peer group.
But if you can be aware of that, try be aware of, you know, your optimism bias, you know, that we all feel like we'll be the ones that avoid the adverse effects of something.
We all think we're different. Well, we all think we're smarter. We never make those mistakes. Humans have this thing, we're wired like, we fail together, it's okay. I don't want to fail out there on my own or be killed off the tribe. Bring me back to your journey though, because I'm curious about how you built this out. So, first couple of years, you built out the membership model, you're off and running, you were doing the meetings, the reports.
Mm-hmm.
You've kind of went your A, B, C, D model.
Yeah.
Step me through how you've built this, because it's a very sophisticated, like your website is a who's who of global movers and shakers. How have you built your own network?
Yeah, I think this is another good question, because I think a lot of people assume when you've built a network or you run a network or one part of your business is that you're a natural networker. I go to very, very few events. If a minister invites me and I have to go, I'll go to an event, or somebody that's a friend that they say, I'd really like you to go to this, I'll go. But I could count on one hand how many events I go to in the course of a year. And I think people assume if you run a network, you're out.
Social butterfly.
Yeah, social butterfly, yeah. And And it's quite useful recognizing this about yourself, because I also, over the years, I was able to see there's certain personality types that are going to buy our membership, you know, and there will be certain ones that just won't. So what has happened over the years when we have lost members is typically the regional CEO moves on to another role, you know, it could be regional CEO of Europe or wherever. And then a new person comes in, and that new person might be, without even attending a session, will be, no, we don't want this membership anymore. We're canceling it. And I can really kind of empathize with that person, because I'd be the person where I'd probably think, yeah. So there's a real kind of personality type to it. So everyone thinks I'm out shaking everybody's hands. I'm actually pretty hard to get hold of. And I'm generally not really, it's a process of how you build a network. It's not one person. And that process becomes, once you have a critical mass, then actually, and this is the psychology of selectivity, making it harder for people to get in. And again, speaking to their irrationality of human beings, people want to be part of it more. And then creating a referral. So the only way now that you can become a member is you're invited by me or you're referred by a member. There's no unsolicited kind of, can I join your membership?
There's no apply here button on the
page. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, and then how I built a network off that has just been, once you get the kernel of the network going and then you refine that, and then it becomes like an engine, a kind of self-fulfilling engine, where often people will say, oh, you know, Trevor knows everybody, I'll introduce them to X, Y, and Z.
Okay.
Which is funny. It's
the perception. It's the reality.
Yeah.
Yeah. You appear well connected. So as a result, you get to be more connected.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I guess that's it. And the referral thing is very important, because once you put the power of referrals in the hands of your members, they also feel more of a stake in the thing, and everybody can be traced back to somebody else as well.
Mm, that's powerful. That's what I do with the podcast. I ask this guest for the next two guests.
Ah, okay, very good. So,
like, I like the psychology piece there. Like, yeah, because that's it. I always say, good people know good people.
Yeah,
I could spend all day like researching and looking up and going on. Same as you. Yeah, don't go to any events.
Yeah,
unless I'm working at it.
Yeah.
Or someone invites me that's a friend who's done me a favor, I'll do them a favor back. No.
Yeah. Just
don't have time, whatever. Getting on my personality type.
And what are the standard of events like in Ireland? Because I went over the years and I spoke at a few of them, but mainly about the Middle East. But that was it. So I feel like I observe Ireland in a way from afar, and I don't feel like I know when I'm there, I'm a very different person. Like all my cells and my body relax. We have a house there, and I feel like a different person.
That's good.
I'm working there, but obviously working on stuff here related to Emir here. I don't have any projects in Ireland, or I don't do any work in the market. So your professional persona doesn't exist in that place.
I know what you mean. I think you should. I think there's a lot of events. I don't think there's a lot of quality events.
Right.
Nothing jumps out at me going, oh, I can't wait for this, to be honest. I sent this to someone recently. Oh, I can't wait for that event, or I can't wait to go to this. I don't see it really that much in Ireland. So what I do is I've just created my own little mini baby version of this. I get guests together. I go, right, I've had 250 guests, 260 guests now. I'll get like a select group of them together. Mm-hmm. The week before I came out, I got a dinner, 14 guests, kind of curated who I kind of thought would be interesting, and kind of like mix and match them together, brought them together for a dinner. Just trying to create my own thing, because I don't want to go to them and they have to be rubbish. So I just go, right, I'll just create an event.
That's a great idea.
Be at it. And I was like, right, there's 14 unbelievably people here. I know they're trying to raise funding. I know that guy's really like engaged to give back. I know this brand is young. They want to kind of, so I just brought all these brilliant people I know. I had to spend hours with them. That's kind of like your thing of like, you kind of curate. And I was like, this is kind of fun because I enjoyed it.
And what is it, like a Jeffersonian type of dinner? Or
kind of not even that. The one problem I call it. Mm. I was like, I want you, because I hate going to events where it's just like, just come to the event. And you're all kind of there and everyone's like just looking around.
What am I doing?
Awkward. And I might get chatting to you, even though you might be the perfect person to talk to me. I don't know, you're there. So I did two things that were kind of different. I got everyone to write me a 3-line bio. What do you do? What's the company doing? And what's your biggest problem? And sent that around before.
Brilliant.
I said, here's the 14 that are coming. If there's someone you particularly want to meet, I'll engineer that. I said, but it's going to be very relaxed. I said, I want you to feel like you're coming into a house. And there's a new place in Dublin, Eamon Lenders set up called Baseline.
Okay.
It's on the third floor of a building. It used to be the press up headquarters. It's beautiful, like almost like a penthouse apartment, but he has his investment fund there and he incubates startups there. And it's beautiful, really, really nice, low lighting, long tables, feels like you're at home. I said, look, I want you to feel like you're at home. I want you to feel like you're a group of friends. I was like, I've selected all these people and I want you to get value. I said, I only want you to come if you've got a problem to solve. I said, I want your problem you're trying to work on right now. I said, it can be tiny.
Yeah.
It can be huge. But
it's a great idea. And it's a great way to bring everyone around together on a kind of shared idea. One idea could be, you know, when we host a lot of intimate sessions, you know, so we'll have one on Friday. We have a big session on Thursday and then we have a smaller one on Friday morning. And we'll have like three objectives for that meeting. So everybody, this is what we always say to everybody. Everyone's very senior. We're all investing our most important non-renewable resource, which is our time. So it's not this type of nonsense where, you know, everyone's going around just shaking, swapping business cards. It's like, we're here.
No name badges.
We're here for
no lanyards.
We're here for this amount of time. These are the three objectives, and this is exactly what's going to happen. Yes. And then at the end, we ask, did we meet these objectives? Yes. Out the door.
Love it.
It's good.
Love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I went to a meeting 2 weeks ago. I try to avoid like any kind of non-specific, the kind of the compelling pitch. I went along and we're half to the meeting. I was like, that's why we're here. Because we're giving me that. And then we did this, and then we did that, and we did this. And I was like, I feel like we're doing a pod, but like there's no gear here. Like, what was that? He was kind of like, because some of those people want to meet me. They kind of want to like talk to me like they're on the pod. I'm like, so I had to go.
That's a great question. I need to ask that question more. Why am I here?
I was like, my wife's waiting for me. What am I doing here? I said, I don't want to be abrupt or upfront, but like, what are we doing here? I was like, what do you need from me? How can I help you?
Yeah.
I'm always very, like, I'll help everybody. I'm like, what can I do to help you? Because I don't know why I'm here. They're like, oh, we're not really kind of sure we're doing this. And I was like, okay, cool. Let's just reconvene in a few weeks. Send me a couple of questions. I'll introduce some intros for you. But I just don't like wasting time. Because I feel I'm not a socially very outgoing person. So if I like to go to something, I could do this all day long. But put me in a room with 30 people who I don't know who they are, what they're doing here.
Yeah.
I'll just be like standing there going, what are we doing?
No, I think you have to be very selective with your time.
But as you get older as well, you're trying to build a network of peers like you've done. So Amir, what's the vision going forward? What's, like, I'm conscious of your time, so I need to get you out of here quite soon. Where do you see this going?
So there's the ABCD, okay? What we would like to do, right?
Don't say E, F, and G.
there could be an E, right?
Okay.
This is the most ambitious part of it, right? So we could be talking in a year's time and it's like, we weren't able to get that off the ground. But with the D, we're currently sitting in between deals.
Yeah.
The E could be that you're sitting in the deals. You're from a private equity perspective.
Yeah.
We have access to LPs here because of the network. We
makes
could
a lot of sense.
OGP. We're constantly being given opportunities. The world does not need another fund, I would say. So,
not another generic fund, but like a fund that was going to do something like that.
Maybe I think that could be that for many years, I was always, as I said earlier, as kind of protecting the network. But obviously, as a kind of growth minded person, you're also thinking, okay, well, how can we do more with it without damaging it? And as I said, there would have been the easy, short-sighted way of just kind of letting people sell into the network. But then over the years came the, okay, we can do the advisory, we can do the deal-making kind of stuff. The last, which would also, if it were to be successful, would be, I feel, the most lucrative and create the most value in the network, would be participating in the investments themselves. And that would be the final I've promised my wife that would be the final chapter.
It makes a lot of sense though.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense.
It's the hardest part though, right?
Really? Have you not done the hardest part? Have you not like built all this goodwill and built all this, like your reputation is everything really in life and business, but like you've spent a lot of time giving, creating value, helping people.
Yeah, maybe the hard part is done in that sense of getting the critical mass and getting the thing moving. As is with everything, you'd have to do it with the right people.
No, for sure.
You know, because I don't have that expertise. You need to be aware of, you need to learn enough about it so that you can, you understand it enough, and then you need to hand it to somebody that can do it way better than you and then just help and facilitate in every way. And that could be the last part of it. But to kind of go back to your question, I'm really just curious of where it could go. Like a good friend of mine just exited from his business. He's a great guy here in Dubai, and we're very close to him and his wife. And it was brilliant to see him build something 15 years, him and his team, and a very successful exit. And since that, obviously, because we're friends, a lot of people have said to me, oh, would you do the same? And I'm kind of like, yeah, I don't know what it is. I guess it's quite an emotional thought process, but I'm just too curious to see what it could eventually be. You know, I feel like it's not about money. It's just, well, I've put a lot of effort into this. Where could it go?
Well, I think being an entrepreneur attracts a certain type of person. It attracts a growth mindset. It attracts like definitely curiosity. But like there's a lot of the great ones aren't really playing with the end game in sight. They're not.
Yeah.
And you know, any of them that I've spoken to who've, you know, exited or whatever, they've just turned around and went, right.
Yeah.
What now?
Yeah, exactly.
And they just go on to the next one. It's an addiction almost. Like, so it's trying to find, look, a great outcome for you and your family, and you know, you want to be financially secure, but they always just go again. They always go to Burj and all that.
But also me and my wife, we don't have kids, so it's a very different calculus, right? So we're okay. You have a different, when you have no kids, I feel like your financial freedom number is pretty easy. You know? So there's a different calculus to it. It's really not about money. It's like it's more the curiosity of where the thing could go. I could get, if you have kids, maybe you'd be more inclined to exit, to take that risk off the table and do that for them. I personally, because I don't have kids, I feel like I can see the kind of Jekyll and Hyde in me. On the one hand, I feel like because I don't have kids, I feel like I'd never give my kids that money anyway. But I know if I had the kids, I would then change my tune, right? Because you have that profound love for them where you're like, no, I want them to be okay. It's easy to say.
Human nature thing. Like, yeah. Do you know what I wish I'd studied in college? Psychology.
Yeah.
If I'd understood my own psychology earlier in life, I think life would have been a lot easier.
And to read people, right? I think that's one of the great things about building businesses is you're forced over time, through enough error, you start to recognize patterns and in people, and you recognize it's not a coincidence. You know, think of your circle of friends or people you know or people you grew up with. There's certain individuals where there's just a repeated pattern. We all have it, right? We have different patterns. Some of them lead to positive outcomes. Some of them lead to negative outcomes. And being able to identify these patterns in individuals, recognizing the level of narcissism in yourself and other individuals, and recognizing when you are confronted by, you know, true narcissism, of how to step away from, tell those people, oh, you're a good person, and walk to the other side of the room. That's hugely beneficial. And I feel like building businesses is a great way to see that, because you're really getting to, working very closely with individuals, and you get a real read, or you get a real feel of people, I think.
It's the ultimate game. Enterprise Ireland helps to support and fund a vibrant startup ecosystem, providing supports, insights, and network connections to the most ambitious Irish startups. From expert advice to raising funding, exploring opportunities in international markets, to strategic planning, Enterprise Ireland is here to support you in those important startup moments. For more information about how Enterprise Ireland can support you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Enterprise Ireland, helping Irish startups go global. Quick fire round.
Oh,
what book would you recommend every founder should read?
I'm funny with books. I don't really read business books.
It can be any book. It doesn't have to be a business book. It's just a book that will improve their thinking or their understanding or just their life.
Well, just because I was talking about that there, the 49 Laws of Human Nature, that's a good one in terms of recognizing narcissism in yourself and narcissism in other people and yeah, how you interact with people. I think that's a very useful one. I personally, if you can try and understand where the world is going, like in terms of big mega developments and how that plays out in a micro sense of people's minds, you know, whether it be like a good example would be you see all this conflict in the world and what I think about a lot is how is it that we can see this conflict on the other side of the planet or see this untold suffering, yet it doesn't drive us into any kind of action or change. Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations at the beginning, he has this kind of thought experiment. There's some natural disaster on the other side of the world and why we don't really care about it. You know, we care enough about it. We care enough about the perception of ourselves to seem like we're concerned about it, but not enough to actually do anything about it. There's an academic, Paul Slavich, who talks about psychophysical numbing. And it's usually portrayed as when numbers get to a certain scale, or they're inconceivable to us. But actually his paper is about, I think the title of it is, The More They Die, The Less We Care. And if you think of what's happened in Palestine recently and you think of what's happening around the world, I think stuff like that, understanding, trying to read about what's happening in the world and then try to tie that in with micro thinking of how we react to things, I'm quite interested in that.
For sure. What have you had to learn the hard way?
I think life is rigged in my favor, to be honest. Everything seems to, even the things, the perception of things that, you know, are perceived as bad, you get so much from them. You learn about an individual, you learn about yourself. So learning the hard way, there's been lots of things, particularly in business, where it would have been easier if it went another direction, but actually you got so much from it.
Is that a reframing you do in your head?
No, I think it's pretty, I try to do that, but I think it's, by and large, there's an opportunity in most things. There's an opportunity to serve someone. There's an opportunity to try be a better version of yourself. There's an opportunity to react in a certain way. We don't get it right all the time. But so, yeah, my wife does often half joke with me, like, we're the people in the movie where everything just goes right for. I know that's very annoying and a lot of people find that.
It's a way to view your life. Happy. Like, that's what we're all trying to do, right?
Yeah.
It's the ultimate goal.
And you're confronted by all the same things that everyone else is confronted.
I think it's a mindset. Look, you're not immune. I'm sure you've had things happen to you in your life, but I like the mindset. Often things in life are a framing. How you frame things and
help
you to, we can see two things happening. We can see the same thing happening. You see in a different way than I do.
Yeah.
There's a lot to be learned from that. What would you do if I give you 10 million euro today?
Low fee index based fund. Yeah, come on. Yeah, I'm not really an entrepreneur, Gary. Honestly, I don't think I'm really an entrepreneur. And probably and you could educate me on this in the sense of the podcast and the traditional sense of an entrepreneur. I'm more probably non-conforming, that I just couldn't understand why you wouldn't go and build something that's, you know, I'm not somebody that, I have different businesses, but I don't think I create them or invest in them for the same reasons as everyone else. Like, I started Amir really because I was like, oh, I can't do that. You know, sit in a big organization and pile the next 15 years into this to get to here. And
it's interesting you say that. Like, you're the second person who sat in that very chair today to say, I don't know if I'm really technically an entrepreneur. My definition of an entrepreneur is if you have something in here and if you can translate it out to the world and it pays your wage at the end of the month.
Oh, then I'm definitely an entrepreneur.
There we go.
I like
business is going to be my thing. I can just go out diagnosing people going entrepreneur, entrepreneur. It's funny how people find that label funny. I find it interesting.
That it is because I'm into the roots of words, right? The etymology of words. And entrepreneurs is an old French word. Now, it's a long time since I read this, but I think it's like to attempt or to try.
Mm.
I think it's something like this. And that, in its sense, I like, but I think it's been kind of bastardized. And now we really just think of it in a tech sense, right? Tech startup.
Yeah, there's a Hollywoodization on it, I think. There's like, you know, the Zuckerbergs of the world, the Musks of the world. They're like the 1%. The rest are the 99% like me and you who just want to build our own thing, do cool things with cool people, have a good life.
Mm.
Kind of how I do it.
Yeah.
It's pretty simple. What would you do today if I give you 1 million euro, which you can only invest in one person or one company, not yourself? Who is it?
No, I'm glad you said not yourself.
I wouldn't say it. It's
me. Yeah.
So I had to put that a little caveat on it.
Right. And so it's 1 million. Say it again to me, 1 million euro.
I'm going
to
give you 1 million euro. You can invest in one person or one company. Who is it?
I'm going to say my nephew sitting in the green room out there. He's 16. I wouldn't give him the 1 million euros. I think that would be irresponsible, but I'd build a plan with him. I think he's a bright young guy, and I'd build a plan with him and I'd do it with him.
Well, that's been a pretty good transition year week for him. He's just got 1 million euros.
But you have to give the 1 million euros.
Dubai really is the land of gold. The myths are true. Last couple of questions. If you were starting a new business again in 2025, what would it be?
Again, it kind of speaks back to the last question. It would depend on the circumstances. You know, if I was starting from zero, I was starting from where I'm starting now. But if I was, I guess it would be more interesting to start from zero.
You don't have your network. You don't have anything.
You know, what I'd probably do is, I think there's I look at things first of what would I want there's probably two ideas that come to mind. What would I want my life to look like, right? So it would depend of where I am and stage in life and that. But if I were younger, I'd give that idea of, you know, looking at demography in countries where there's an oversupply and buy that and then Airbnb and leverage and do that over and over. That would be one. And then a lot of the guys I grew up with are, you know, tradesmen, builders, electricians. A great friend of mine does smart homes, David Keane. smarthomes.ie, I think he is. Give him a plug there.
Shout out.
I think that's it. But what I would I listen to them a lot, right? And they all have, you know, small one-man businesses. And when I meet them, I'm curious about this because it's very far removed from me, but I'm curious about how they're approaching these things. And I did think again about how society is changing and the prestige that we put to certain knowledge. And because of that, how there's going to be a huge opportunity, right? So for example, you know, the last 20, 30 years, there's been this overproduction of elite degrees and most of it is postmodern gibberish, right? Including a lot of the stuff that I done. And then during that period, there were a lot of people that didn't go to university and they went down the route of vocational training, electricians, etc. Now what you have in developed economies is you have an oversupply of elite degrees, white-collar workers that are going to be hurt by AI, and then you have blue-collar workers who have proven business models, right? They've, as you said earlier, pay yourself a salary. They've paid themselves a salary for 20, 25 years. But what they're lacking is that kind of, and hope they won't find this unfair, but a kind of a layer of sophistication in terms of business acumen, in terms of software, systems, AI. And you could do a syndicate of private, I wouldn't do this because this, you know, I wouldn't be allowed back into Ireland. I'd be excommunicated as a filthy capitalist. But what you could do is you could bundle all of these together. And what you're going to have in the future is, depending on how quickly Gen AI leaps into the physical world, which could be sooner than we think, what you're going to have is, because we put this nonsense label of prestige onto a certain type of knowledge, I went to university, right? And we did not attach that prestige to blue collar jobs. You, from a supply and demand point of view, you don't have enough of these people in advanced economies going into these areas now. And I was with a friend of mine in the Alps last year, and he has a beautiful place there, and he built something in the upstairs part of it, a small wall. And when he told me the cost of it, I was like, what? He said, well, I don't know how to do it, and there's no tradesmen here. So they're charging like heart surgeons. And it made me think, I was like, yeah, that's the way the world is going. And when these guys, at least when they come into my house and they open an electric box, that shows how much I know about it, I might as well be looking at open heart surgery.
Yeah, it is.
So I think there's probably a business model in that.
That was one of my ideas as well. As yeah. Electricians, professionalize the whole thing, call it Sparks, and then yeah. You do apprenticeship programs, start training up younger, but professionalize it.
And it's going to have to happen.
Digitization. I've chased a boiler repair guy for 6 months, and I finally got one, and he's booked out 2 months in advance.
Is that there?
I'm waiting.
Yeah.
And I'm quite happy to wait, but he can't. And none of it's digitized. Can't just book an appointment. Yeah. There's huge. I'm with you on that one. I'll go 50-50 on you on that one. It has to happen. It will happen. It just, we might not have the labor to do it. What's been your worst investment?
Worst investment? Look, I've learned something from everything. So I've made a lot of angel investments, obviously. And as you would expect, some of them didn't work, but some of them are looking very good. And I learned something in all that process. And that was the only reason why I got involved in that, was just even the group of other angels, just the whole process around it. Losing money on that was well worth it. And there's a few in there that look like they're going to be quite good.
That's the next question. What's been your best investment?
I guess best investment has been Amir in that sense. And then I'm low fee index based funds for a long time. That's my freedom fund. That's done. And then Angel for Learning.
How do you angel invest? Is it like
in a group?
With a group?
Yeah.
In
Dubai.
UAE?
Okay. Yeah. Period. And they're all, again, networked. They're all interesting people. The challenge is it's time and allocation of time and being able to interact with these people. Yeah.
What's your final piece of advice for every entrepreneur listening or aspiring entrepreneur listening, since we now know you are one?
Identify patterns in people. Everyone around you, for good or ill, has certain patterns. None of us are perfect. Recognize your own patterns as well. And then once you identify these, and once they're tolerable, like once they're not off the charts on terms of narcissism and doing horrific things to the people around them, once it's manageable, then work with those people. You know, if they're really skilled here and you want to work with them, then it makes a lot of sense. And recognize you have that as well. You have your own flaws. And then just, I think, focusing on trying to improve them.
I normally finish by saying, where can people learn more about you and your company?
Oh, they can't. For free. they can't.
That's it. Cut camera.
No, they can't. Realistically, they're not going to be one of our clients. And they want him to become a member.
What a flex. And that is the end of the podcast. Thanks for tuning in.
No, thank you so much for having me, Gary.
Sure, right.
Cheers, man. Thank you.